Welcome to a special episode of the Big Beatles Sort Out, a show in which I, author and musician Gary Abbott, ranked all of the Beatles' core catalogue releases back in Series 1 with the help of my Beatles expert brother Paul. Except, it wasn't all the Beatles' core catalogue releases, was it? Little were we to know that 3 years later we'd be getting a brand new official Beatles song, Now and Then. So please join us as we try and finally sort out the Beatles.
This is it.
Yes, we here we are. Basically, this is Series 1 episode extra, isn't it? We've gone back.
I think the Beatles have done this just to annoy ranking podcasts. Yeah. It's mainly to get at us and at ranking the Beatles.
Yeah, we thought we had it all...
Mess our systems up.
All sewn up, didn't we? And then they're like, just you wait, buddy. And I don't know if we even talked about it back then, if we even acknowledged the idea that there might be more.
Well, we did Free as a Bird and Real Love, and I may have talked about the fact that there was other stuff that they were attempting at the time. Yeah. But if we did, it certainly wouldn't have been with the idea that it was ever going to be revived, that they'd ever go back to them, and we'd ever be sat here going, the new final Beatles song.
Yeah.
And it's a couple of weeks after it's been out, and it's been a number one hit in the UK. It's,
yep. I know.
It's a very bizarre thing.
It's crazy. And I know people have been eagerly awaiting our take on this because it's been all quiet.
Clamouring.
In Beatles podcast and fandom, has it? No one's had any kind of an opinion on it yet. So we thought we'd wait a good couple of weeks. As you might hear from me throughout this episode, is I've had a bit of a sore throat and a cold. So I'm a bit husky and I might cough here and there. But it was a... We've had to wait a little bit longer. We wanted to give it a bit of time to bed in as well.
Yes, yeah, it's seeped in. And I think there is something about Now and Then which does sort of seep into the brain and the heart a little bit.
It does, and I'll be interested.
It makes it sound like a terrible medical complaint. Yeah, but...
it definitely is a grower, I think is the right way to say it. It'd be interesting because I wrote my notes quite early on from it being released, and then I'm coming back to them a couple of weeks later, so I might be reading my own notes going, well, I've changed my mind.
Who was
about
this
now.
Idiot?
Yeah, so we'll see, but it doesn't really matter. Let me just do some of the usual, seeing as we have started the episode. Don't forget you can keep in touch with us at @big_sort on Twitter and Instagram, or by email to bigbeatlesortout@gmail.com, and do please drop us a review on whatever platform you're listening on if you can, and like and share our posts. And check
we're on Threads as well, don't forget.
On Threads.
Which is, I don't know if that's got any reach at all. Tell us if we need to be on Blue Sky. We can do that, you know.
Yeah, it's too confusing. Please check the episode description for links, as always. And, I never got to do my proper introduction, so I was going to say, special welcome to Paul. Well, I never Abbott. That was all. It's not really that clever. Paul, well, I never Abbott. I don't know.
What does that? It's not even a joke on anything.
No, it's not. I don't. I must.
You're obviously not well, Gary.
No. So what we're going to do is basically return to Series 1 in the sense that we're going to do the...
Brilliant. Some sighing and being annoyed to...
to do the,
old school.
To do the ranking for Now and Then to fit it in to the chart, which is...
Yeah.
Which is crazy, and it's you'll see as we talk about it. I don't think, even when you do fit it in, wherever you place it, it just doesn't. It's strange because it's so new to you. Haven't lived with it for long enough yet, but it would be fun to try and find out. So, yeah, and then we're going to talk
because we haven't talked about it either, have we? Not for much other than like perhaps a couple of messages on WhatsApp.
No, we've been busy.
Sat and chatted about it.
I was out and about. I was on a little mini holiday when it came out, and I didn't even get a chance to listen to it till that evening. And then, even then, I was in a hotel room without any proper headphones, so I listened to it on my phone, which is a really bad way to listen to anything, by the way, but like with my phone without headphones. So I was hearing all sorts of trebly bits that I didn't quite get because I couldn't hear the full mix. And it really needs... Yeah. You know, you really need to listen to it through proper headphones or speakers.
Well, I obviously, when it was coming out, it was sort of lunchtime.
Yes.
And in Liverpool, where it was raining, I was at work. And I'd just come back from lunch with a friend, and I went and I found somewhere in a corridor that I thought was going to be quiet and no one ever goes down because I work in a basement.
Yeah.
And I found a little bit of a corridor and I went and stood there. I put my nice earphones in because I've got some nice AirPods and stuff like that. And obviously everything gets published in Atmos mixes and all that sort of stuff now.
Mm.
I put my AirPods in and one of them just didn't work.
Oh, brilliant. Perfect.
And it's like, hang on, have they mixed this so it's in one ear? Like, it's like, no.
Extreme left.
My expensive air. Yeah. It's like, it's going to be like a tribute to the two track mixes of the old days. But no, one of my AirPods for the first time, and it hasn't done it since. It's just stopped working.
It's almost spooky, Paul.
And then as I was listening to it, before it got to the end, I think it got to about where the guitar solo comes in, and someone was lost in the and came down this corridor that no one ever goes down and needed some help getting out of the building. And so my first listening was just,
get out!
Leave me a beat! I'm doing Beatles! So it was completely interrupted, which is just given the amount of anticipation and waiting and preparing and making sure I was ready there to go listening to it. It was like, oh, typical.
I was totally underprepared. And I think I might even have been driving at the time. It was like officially, I wouldn't have been driving because I would have put it on the radio. We were just not in a place where I could be listening to it at the time. And so I didn't really listen to the Friday when I got back home and got my headphones on and proper listened to it and then really absorbed it. And I've listened to it quite a lot since then. The best listen I've had was when it came on the radio, which is quite rare for me because I only put it on when I'm in the car. And it was like Radio 2 was on and Vernon Kay was like, well, I never thought I'd be saying this, but here they are, the Beatles. And then it was great to hear it in that context because it's like, that's a bit more, it's a bit less kind of in your bubble, then, isn't it? And it's a bit more, it's happening to everyone else.
It's always interesting to experience stuff in different contexts. So I was still sort of soaking it in on the Saturday and I kind of didn't know exactly what I felt about it at the time. I'll mention this now because it's come up sort of in this part of the conversation, but I went out with my friend Steve-O and we went and I had a nice old man walk down the road, went to the grocers and some charity shops. And then as we came back, we got to the top of Penny Lane. And at the top of Penny Lane is St. Barnabas's Church where Paul McCartney was a choir boy. And they had a thing called the Good Market on, which is like loads of independent people selling all sorts of stuff. And my friend Pete was DJing in there.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, you know what? We'll go in and we'll have a little look round. And I went up to Pete and I'd not seen him since the record had come out. We'd messaged and stuff. He was going to play it. And so I got to hear it in St. Barnabas's Church, played off a vinyl, off the 7-inch. It's a place where Paul McCartney had been singing as a choir boy and out loud. And it sounded fantastic.
Yeah.
In that context, to have it suddenly out loud. Pete doesn't play Beatles stuff. He does loads of really cool DJing. He plays lots and lots of Beatles covers, of soul music particularly, like covers.
Yeah.
So this was like the first time he was like, I'm playing a Beatles single under the guise of my DJ setup type thing.
Yeah.
And apparently he got asked to play it several more times
that
day as well. And it just sounded amazing. So I posted a little video at the time because that was my moment with it.
Mm.
Sort of made up for the weird abortive first attempt the day before.
I think, oh, that's good. I think mine was in the car, as I say. Not half as a bit
not
more
the day before,
I was gonna say a bit more pedestrian than yours, but it's exactly not that. A bit more automotive than yours. But that thing of being in the moment, or in a national moment of being like, oh, it's just on the radio because it's about to be number one. And yeah, because I think back in the, I don't know, the real Love Free as a Bird days, I don't know, they never got to number one for a start, which is obviously something that's now happened and we all know that.
It's a very, very different landscape
that
they're released in. It's obviously, in some ways, it's more like the 60s in that they were pushing out physical product and the physical product being vinyl particularly.
Yeah.
And they have sold lots of vinyl by the standards of the modern age.
Yeah.
But obviously we now have streaming as well. And we also have a more sympathetic broadcast media to the Beatles because they have, Free as a Bird, Real Love weren't getting airplay. particularly.
No.
On the major stations, on, you know, they were getting onto Radio 2 and stuff like that because it was seen as legacy music.
Yeah.
So it wasn't getting the wide, broad coverage that we have got for now and then. But yeah, it's a different landscape, and it's decades on. No one was expecting this now.
Yeah.
It's a whole weird other thing, and
it happened, and
it's just mad.
And it's happened on our watch, and we could count ourselves lucky for that.
Yeah.
As Beatles fans, you know, brilliant. Brilliant to have this out there, and you know, without giving too much away, glad that it wasn't crap. So, well, at least I think so. Anyway, you know, I never thought it was going to be, because I'm not a miserable old person. I always thought it was going to be something that's going to be worthwhile. You know, I don't care. I'm not taken in by all this AI scaremongering or kind of scraping the barrel kind of. Like moaning, it's fine. Give me Beatles. It's what's the matter with you? You
know? Yeah.
So you know, genuinely like it. So you dive into finding out why, or do you want to talk more generally around it?
Well, there's not really much more to say in the introduction to it. No one needs us now to explain what it is or how it was made.
We've all heard that
because
story.
That has been well covered by the official channels. That. One of the best things, I think, was the little mini film that was released the day before, with the sort of heart-stopping moment of hearing the vocal in isolation.
Mm.
Everyone knows about Peter Jackson and the MAL technology that they've used. We know who the players are in terms of production and who does what and strings and this, that and the other. So we know it's a John tape from the 70s,
yep.
Tried in the 90s. Revisited it now.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's plenty of other people who are talking about that if you want to go and find other podcasts where they do that in more detail.
Yes, we won't cover all that old ground here. I can't believe it's old ground. It's like literally from about 3 weeks ago, but it's been well trodden already. So we'll just get on with it and sometimes go back to how we used to do things, which is to start with the music then. Yeah. So first up we have, and only up, Now and Then.
And now and then, if we must start again, well, we will know for sure that
right, Now and then. So,
then
music, Paul. So, skipping past the tuning up sounds to start with, which we'll talk about in production, we kind of start with that deep piano, and by deep, you know, it's down the kind of register a bit, isn't it? Now, that piano, this is a production thing really, is retracked piano, isn't it now? That's not the original piano, it's been retracked.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
So, I mean, shall I do what I normally do? I'll do the credits in terms of who plays what.
Because they published these
and there's a little mystery in here that I'm interested in.
Mm.
So vocals are listed as John Lennon and Paul McCartney. Backing vocals are listed as John, Paul, George and Ringo.
Right, okay.
And we know that Ringo recorded new vocals for this as well. So he's in that mix now. And we know that they utilised some stuff from old records as well. Guitars, George Harrison. That's guitars, two.
Plural.
Probably two, but it's plural, yeah. Mm. Then we have guitars, bass, piano, electric harpsichord, shaker, Paul McCartney, drums, tambourine, shaker, Ringo Starr.
Mm.
So,
where's the electric harpsichord?
Well, that's the mystery, you see. That's the mystery. So if you think about Real Love in the 90s, that's got electric harpsichord on it, and very clearly. And I wonder if that credit is a bit of a hangover from those sessions, but why would it be in the credits now? I cannot hear it or place it at all, really. But maybe something will crop up at some point, someone will reveal what it is.
Maybe in 50 years' time, someone will use demixing technology.
Yeah, to demix this in order to split the electric harpsichord off from the piano.
Yeah. So that's all the credits, isn't it? And then obviously all the...
Well, strings as well. Basically. So you have, and those are listed as being arranged by Paul Giles Martin and Ben Foster. And I'm glad to say that it looks like most of the people who played on it are credited in things like Wikipedia and stuff like that now.
Good.
So because it's not quite the same as the sort of sadly faceless people who played in these various ensembles in the past that never got recorded on the sheets.
Can we?
So that's nice.
That is nice. Can we clear something up about guitars, even though I'm sure it's been covered elsewhere? Because some of the moaners talk about, you know, it's not really George, because Paul recorded in the style of George, some of the slide guitar stuff. And then I've read some bits...
All of the slide guitar stuff.
Yeah, but then I've read some bits that it's only really that second verse, kind of more choppy guitar, funky guitar, that's original George. But, I mean, he sounds like he's... Is he also strumming an acoustic as well? And he's... Do we know what...
I would go with what Giles Martin said on the... I would listen to... I did quite a short interview, but a good one, with the BC The Beatles podcast.
Right.
And he said George is on guitars, acoustic and electric.
Yeah. So I think it's a double-tracked acoustics, isn't it?
Yeah. And if you look at some of that footage in the mini-films and the various bits of video that go with this, you can see them working on this song and they're both playing acoustics.
Yeah.
And so I reckon what's happened is we've got those little choppy electric guitar bits from George and a pass at least some of the chords in the song on acoustic. And then I think Paul's obviously dropped in like a guitar lick and the solo to pick up what George had laid down in the 90s.
Yeah.
Okay. I think.
Okay, well, that's that covered then. So... Any more players? Are we okay? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we start off with the piano moving between two very soulful and melancholic chords, which is the theme of the song, although it has hope in there, which comes out later. Interesting, because the kind of chords, it's like not quite an E minor or a G, is it? It's kind of
Yeah, I quite like this. It's
G with an E in it, I think, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, so it's.
Which is it?
It's A minor to G, except it's not a G. It's a G with an E, which makes it either a G6, which is a very Beatle chord, or it's an E minor 7 over G in the bass.
Yeah.
I don't know where I fall fully on that. I think it's probably a G6 technically, because what John was playing on his piano part, and which Paul now picks up in the redo of it, is going along with the melody pattern.
Yeah.
Which gives it a bit of strange movement. But yeah, I like that. If it had just been like an A minor to a G, it would have been very, very normal. But that weird little E note in there makes
makes it
interesting.
Slightly just that thing that, this is that Lennon skill, really, of something that's seemingly simple, just having enough done to it to make it interesting. Because otherwise, it's quite a straightforward kind of verse, isn't it? But then John's voice comes cutting in above it all, hauntingly kind of clear and strong because of the technology and because of his performance of it. I mean, I've heard the original demo and he sings it well. He sings it well for a demo. It's just that the demo is the quality it was, you know, and that's great. And although the melody and chords of the verses seem simple, there's just a few little movements at the end of the phrases where his ability to turn that simple idea into something more comes across. There's hope introduced in the chord changes when it goes to whatever it is, an F or something. His voice does those little rundowns in the second repeats.
Yeah.
You know, da da da.
I think that's the thing that gets it. The thing that makes it a winner for me, almost above all else, is the fact that John's melody is really, really interesting.
Yeah.
And he does those little melismatic bits at the end of phrases.
That's the word.
I would never have expected. And I don't think anyone... If you said write in the style of John Lennon, I don't think anyone would ever have done anything like that.
Which is why this is good, because that's not how the... If you'd have done something that sounded like what you thought the Beatles would sound like, it wouldn't have made any sense, because that's not how they worked. Not how John worked.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of folk have done this is how the song would have sounded in 1964. And some of it's very, I mean, it's a great exercise and I love that people are doing it and taking it and running with that sort of thing, but they always sound like an explosion in a Beatles factory. You know, they throw everything at it. It's like, okay, the tambourine, but really loud, and the 12-string guitar, and the piano from Not a Second Time type thing, and those harmonies, and this, that, and the other,
but they were,
which is not a Beatles thing to do all of it at once.
Exactly. Unless, you know,
and they don't do it here either, so it's...
No, and at the end of the verses, he has that kind of slide up of the chord back onto the Because of You, kind of almost like a suspended, but it's kind of like the chord kind of slides back to where it was going.
Yeah, and the melody never quite sort of drops onto, doesn't go. You know, it doesn't fall down at any point. It doesn't round off. It's always doing something interesting.
So yeah, so the verses immediately hit me, like, you know, and you get a repeat. You get a second. The first verse kind of comes back again, with the strings starting to build up and the drums coming in and everything, and then you get our first kind of. Chorus. So the first, when I'm reading these notes now, remembering that the chorus didn't hit me straight away as much as the verses did. It took me a little longer to get on with it because partly the problem was the first time I heard it, the choruses didn't come across very well on my tinny phone. They were better with the listening. And I thought at first maybe it was more of a holding chorus, that something he might have worked up later down the line from the initial idea. But the more I listen, the more I like it, where the kind of chorus takes you as a counterpoint from the verses. And the more I can start to hear Ringo and Paul and John all singing in there.
Yeah.
Which I couldn't really hear Ringo till I saw him. And once I've seen him singing on the video, I can now hear his voice in there. Kind of like a weird, needed that kind of connection to be made.
I know what you mean.
It seems, this is more of a production thing. It seems that at first, when I first heard it, I found it a little bit like out of sync because they're all singing in unison and the words don't all end exactly at the same time or start exactly at the same time. So I'm like, I'm trying to like zone in on it. And it's like, eh. But then that has fallen away the more I've listened to it. So, you know, I think it's just... your brain eagerly trying to take it all in and being distracted by anything that's slightly even going to not be going to take you out of it. The chorus is great, and I'm glad that when I listened back to the demo, it is part of what was originally there as well. It wasn't a free as a bird type of there's just a big whacking hole that needs something. It's what he wrote, really, isn't it? It's just been beefed up. You know,
They have jettisoned one.
They've jettisoned that bridge section, haven't they?
Yeah. So they jettisoned the "I don't want to lose you" section, which I always thought listening to the demo is the bit where John sort of shift keys, and it's a bit of a weird shift.
Yeah.
But I hadn't twigged this in terms of listening until old pal Chris Shaw from Megpod mentioned sort of online the phrase "the I don't want to lose you." Is in there. It's quoted on a piano very subtly about 2 minutes and 40 seconds in.
Right.
It's like, so there is a little reference. There's a little melodic motif reference to the missing section that they cut out, which I think is a fantastic, very Beatley thing to do.
Yeah.
To have an Easter egg or something just extra to listen to.
Yeah.
In there, even if it's, well, I mean, that's deliberate, but, you know, there are what you'd call production faults, in air quotes, here as well, even in this, which is a very Beatles thing as well. You know, the legacy of the squeaky drum pedal or similar is still present even now.
Yeah. We'll talk about that in production, I guess.
Yes.
But, so we get, you know, a second repeat of the verse, and it's all got, by that point, it's all up and going at that point. It's all kind of, you know, the strings are well in there and they're sounding good as well. And then we get to, I really like the mid-8 solo with I think that's brilliant. The strings are building, the backing vocals, the modulation of the chords into that kind of almost day in the life, kind of epic, ethereal, transcendent type of realm, really, which is also comes back in the outro, which I also really love. We start to get some Eleanor Rigby-esque kind of string strokes really going on in the outro and building that drama and tension to that great final few bars where we get our most Martin-esque type of bit of a arrangement, I think. But
yeah, well, I mean, it is a Martin. Well, it's Giles Martin.
It's Giles Martin.
But yeah. So he's mimicking like his dad's style of him and his arranger Ben Foster are working with Paul to sort of play in a George Martin style, and it's a very George Martin 1967 style.
Yeah,
you know, it's although it does sort of have that Eleanor Rigby-esque hard stroke section, dun dun chunk chunk
at the end,
but it does particularly has that rundown, which is Walrus essentially, isn't it?
Yeah.
So
it's the very end.
But it's a nice arrangement.
That bit. The very outro that's got Within You Without You as well in it, and kind of just that's the most Martin.
Oh yeah, I didn't really twig like that. Yeah, I know what you mean.
The rest of it's kind of more, I think the difference here is that they are doing it in a Martin-esque Frozen in Time type of way, whereas I think if George Martin was still around, he may not have done what we'd expect him to have done, which is what you just can't know that, can you? You can't know what he would have done. He may have had the blocked strings, but he well have introduced something that we wouldn't even have thought of and we'll never know.
He might have used a different type of orchestra, you know.
Yeah.
One of my favourite things about George Martin's orchestral writing is his use of woodwind. And he might have gone for something like that. But they've picked something that works in a sort of, in a more pad format, which is what strings are often used to flesh out.
Which is somewhere in the production that we'll get onto. But generally, it's they're a great addition musically as well.
Yes,
to this.
Definitely.
And I wasn't really sure what I thought at first of the George's kind of guitar in the second verse, the kind of choppy kind of chords, because it seemed a bit too funky for the rest of the song. Like they'd gone down that route and decided not to bother, but they've used it because they got it. But again, it's just settled in over time. It just feels fine to me now. It feels all good.
Mm-hmm.
I like it, and I think having those things that make you take notice is probably part of the genius of it, because if you wasn't taking notice of it, it might just be because it's boring, and it certainly isn't boring. So that's another one of those things that draws you in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, let me think. What else have we got? Harmonies, obviously. I mean,
yeah, and we'll get, I think, production where we'll talk about some of that.
Musically, the harmonies, though, obviously, I think they work really well. And they do bring that Beatles kind of ability to
thank heavens they recorded a load of block chord harmonies in the
60s. Yeah. But then there's some very, very, very subtle harmonies. And this may be part of production about where Paul is and isn't doubling with John in the verses.
Yes.
Because it's very, very, very subtle.
Yes, there is. There's a couple of moments of just strengthening.
Yeah.
But not quite as much as they had to do with Free as a Bird, because the actual thing that they've got to sing along with isn't
so
quite as hard
to hear,
they don't need to soften it as much as they did with Free as a Bird and Real Love.
But then to round off the music, Paul's bass is great throughout.
It's proper Macca bass there. In fact, I think it's fascinating, that bass playing. To have something like that, to have as an example of his ability as a bass player.
Yeah.
Because it's not really Beatles bass playing in some respects, because he tended to, you know, he could do obviously melodic stuff, think of, you know, something and stuff like that. But he would tend towards that as a feature but then spend most of the time doing good, groovy, rocky root note stuff. It flows like an absolute dream. I think it's an absolutely beautiful bass part in this, and I'm of all the things Paul's done to this, which is essentially everything. I think that is, if you're going to leave that as a legacy in your last Beatles song, that's a brilliant thing to do for him.
Yeah, it's got some great bits in there, and I like, it's something he re-recorded, so he'd obviously gone back to what he did in the 90s and thought, I can do that better. Well, in fact, that's exactly what he said, isn't it?
Yeah,
and he does.
Same with Ringo's drums as well. Ringo's they got rid of Ringo's 90s drums and said, look, we can do this better.
Solid and as apt as you'd ever expect. And the added percussion is, you know, brings in that real Ringo
tambourine sound. Classic Beatles tambourine.
And yeah, it just adds that motif from the early years, but also just rounds out that kind of Ringo is responsible for the percussion, you know. Well, the Beatles are responsible for percussion. They consider it beyond just the kit as well, don't they? And it all works together. So, yeah, I mean, it's a great bit of music. It's a really nice bit of music. And it's... And whether it was a Lennon song or... And whether he'd have made it up to something like this, or whether they came and did it, it's in itself, without that, I think it's a great piece of music. And I've given it, based on the charts of what we've kind of looked at before, 81 for music.
Right, okie dokie.
81. So that's that. So let's move on to production, because we've already, so much of this is wound up in production. It's a big category to chew on, isn't it?
Yeah. Without trying to stray into how they made it,
yeah,
which we've said we're not going to do, there are things in here that leap out. The fact is that it isn't a Jeff Lynne production, so it doesn't sound like Real Love and Free as a Bird.
No.
Particularly in Ringo's drums.
Yeah.
They don't sound like bin lids anymore. And Ringo's performance is more fluid, I would say.
Mm.
That's not me being down on his performance per se in the other songs, but I think that was famously he was locked to a click and those ones, and this one he's not, he's playing to the material. Yeah, I think that's brilliant. But there are, like I say, so Mike, I'll get my production things out of the way first. Yeah. There are a couple of little fun things, things that shouldn't be there that they've left in. So they've got the count in at the start.
Yeah, they've got the
which, one, two, three, and it sort of tails
is
off.
Is it me? Or, because there's different bits of tuning and counting in, isn't there? Are they, little bits from each decade that they were made in? Is there a bit of tuning in studio noise being...
I can't really tell that there. But I just hear that Paul Paul counting.
I thought it feels to me like there's a little bit of...
There might be something there in the background, and maybe I need to lie down in the dark and put my headphones on loud.
Well, that's my theory.
Yeah. But yeah, maybe, I don't know. They've got that at the start, and then at the end you can just about hear Ringo say something.
Right.
Just at the very point it stops.
Yeah.
Like something like Good One, or That Was a Good One, or something.
Yeah.
Like, something.
Yeah, I've heard him say that, yeah.
But they also have weird things like, so that lap steel guitar that he's playing,
because
I think it's a lap steel rather than a normal guitar with a slide. I don't know, but that's what I think. It's got those big reverb-y sound, that big spacey sort of noise that it is, that makes it so fantastic in the solo. But there's a point where you can hear like a pop, pop sort of noise. And it's clearly the sound of him resting his palm on the guitar. You know, when you've got loads of effects on your guitar.
Yeah.
And even if you don't play something, you can, if you touch your guitar strings, it might...
starts to modulate it and delay it and all sorts of things.
It'll just pick up any little tiny thing. And that's still in the mix towards the end. 3 minutes, 49 seconds for anyone looking for the weird noises where it's like...
Cool.
And I love the fact that with all the technology now... This stuff could easily have been eliminated. Why would you have a count in at the start? Why would you have the sound of someone speaking at the end? Why would you have these two little unbidden things that you could just snip out? But they're there, you know, which is a very Beatles thing.
Yeah. I mean, similarly to... I thought the same about the fact that it's not exactly... The chorus, they're not exactly in sync with each other all the time.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of kind of like that natural... byproduct you get of trying to sing.
Yeah, and they could have shuffled that.
They could have shuffled could it have in easily.
Nudged it in Pro Tools. They could have blocked it off to make it absolutely spot on, millisecond perfect, microsecond perfect, nanosecond perfect, whatever.
What's the next? I want to know what the next level of perfect is.
I don't know if I was working in the right direction anyway.
Okay.
I don't know. And then it would have been a bit weird and computery.
Well, exactly. This is the thing, you see. So, like, at first, it was my ears had to go, oh, they're not quite in with each other. Then I thought, well, especially as we'll talk about a little bit later, having re-listened to the Red and Blue compilations, they weren't always very, sometimes they weren't even singing the same words as each other. You're lucky if they were singing the same line, let alone singing at exactly the same time.
Singing the same song.
Yeah. So yeah.
In one corner, John's singing She Loves You, in the other, Paul's singing Tip of My Tongue.
I actually did once play in a band, covers band, where it was, rather than pay us, they gave us a free bar. And we were there for a couple of hours before we even started playing. And by the time we were playing, we were that drunk that at one point we were actually playing different songs at the same time. Because we just, it was all rock and roll stuff. Anyway.
And you've not been invited back since.
No.
While I'm on a thought while we're talking about that, with the voices not necessarily seeming to lock in rhythm, exact timing wise, because they lock in harmonically.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Definitely. You also have that fact that they've got Paul's voice now as an 80 something year old man.
Yes, yeah.
Against John's, which I think is interesting because it sort of exposes a certain fragility in Paul's vocal because it's not. The control that you might have as a younger man with your voice is not necessarily there. He's not gone in for that pure smooth thing. He's gone in, and it's quite an emotional, in terms of what you call the emotional part of the song, hearing things like that, that voice singing that way, that line type thing.
It is. It's one of those ones that, again, it's settled on me because, yes, when you sing, because he's singing so differently than John, it does expose it, and therefore it does make it sound even more a little bit out with each other. Not out, like you say, harmonically or
not in a bad way.
You know, it's just
it's not a Queen style like pure harmony.
And then you realise it is because Paul's voice has a natural kind of timbre to it,
got a little bit of a natural sort of age vibrato
to it. And then it reminds me of things like Johnny Cash, you know, and he's doing things like Hurt and things like that. It's actually. It's a stately kind of voice, someone who's of experience. But when you put that against John singing in his kind of what would have been his late 30s, would it kind of, you know, it's you can hear those two things. But they've grown on me as that kind of like the two voices are stretched over time together. I think it is great that they didn't do any de-aging or anything like that.
Well, you remember, I don't know if you remember, that one of the first rumours that came out about this was Penn Jillette.
Yes, yeah, we did talk about it in a previous episode. Yeah. But
he was told, or he reported that he was told that they were using de-aging technology on Paul's voice. And, I mean, obviously they haven't.
No.
But I wonder if at one point they were thinking about it and they tried it and went, no, this isn't right.
Yeah.
This isn't sort of musically or morally the right thing to do.
It's probably just someone who's getting the wrong end of the AI stick again, as always. But
Penn Jillette, who's mad as a hatter.
I mean, I know we don't want to go into
that. I hate the fact that he was sort of right about everything else. It's very annoying.
I mean, all I will say about the technology used to demix John's voice and whatever is that it's just bafflingly. I'm going to get stuck in it. It's impressive.
It certainly is.
And I think, you know, even if they had to do a big education piece to kind of stop people thinking that the Terminator was coming to release a Beatles song, it was good to show the kind of things.
Actually, an explosion in an automated Beatles factory.
When you listen to the original demo, it's not that bad. As I thought,
I mean, some of the stuff that's turned up on YouTube has been cleaned
already
up a little
bit. Oh, that might be why.
Yeah, because there was like a constant like mains hum or something like that, which I think if you hear a version with that still in it, but actually that getting rid of that mains hum now is easy, easy peasy. You can probably do that in Audacity.
Yeah.
You can certainly do it in Audition. It's all the other stuff, the pulling apart of the pieces without losing the harmonic content of the piano, the voice.
And
noise.
I do feel like you can still hear within it a little bit, a bit of digital product that's come out of it. It has to obviously fill in some gaps. There's just bits that it must have gone, well, that was this frequency. There's a bit of a gap because there's a piano that's right over the top of it, but we can take a good guess, being AI, that it will be that, you know. And so you can hear a tiny bit, just a very little bit, like you could hear on a very mild pitch correction kind of digital.
I do agree.
When it's exposed.
A very critical listen, and it has to be a very sort of critical, close listen. will reveal those sorts of things. And I think the same is true of some of the mixes on Red and Blue.
But
the whole effect, fortunately, it's a bit like looking at a pointillist painting close up. You know, yeah. You need to stand back to see exactly. the whole picture no, exactly. rather no. than the individual component parts.
You can hear a little bit of it if you're listening very closely to it, especially on a kind of exposed vocal, not just within the song, when you play it like on its own. But then you tell me a song now that hasn't got a perfectly able and alive person in the studio right in front of them who can take as many takes as they want, but who still hasn't got pitch correction all over it anyway. We're used to hearing that digital kind of sound. And it's only a tiny bit. I do wonder if it'll be a bit like CGI, that as we go forward into the future, I don't know what it'd be compared to, because CGI, you're comparing it back to itself. You think it's amazing, and then 5 years later, you think, oh, why did we used to think that was amazing? There isn't going to be a precedent for this.
Yeah, you're looking at the Pierce Brosnan Bond films going, what?
Yeah. So you're like, there's not going to be a precedent for this, is there? Because it won't be like there'll be John Lennon's voice being demixed from things increasingly better every year. It won't be like that. So I don't think it'll I'm just, what my main point was that I think they've done a brilliant job with the technology and the decision to use that technology, and how that ultimately ends up in us being able to hear the decades in this. We have John and his piano part, but we have the mid-90s Beatles, which you can hear in there, and you've got
We have the 60s stuff as well. So we've got Here, There and Everywhere, block harmony chords, thank you, backing vocals. We have Because, block harmony chords, and we have like literally a snip out of Eleanor Rigby, which has been very carefully used to bolster certain syllables.
Right, okay.
Ah, syllables.
Yeah. Your syllables.
Ah, A-H.
Yeah, okay.
Clever boy. And that's been done, you know, very well. I think that's good. So before you give your sort of verdict on this, let me say that I still think they perhaps could have been bolder at the start of this, much as it's grown on me since I wrote this down in my notes. But imagine if, instead of having an acoustic guitar, a piano and the voice at the beginning, you had an acoustic guitar and the voice.
Yeah.
Or a piano and the voice. Gave that voice even more space to breathe, to be revealed. Imagine if they pulled back some of the strummy guitars to let the strings do more later on.
There's quite a lot. It's quite a blocky production.
It is by the end.
It's got quite a 90s anthemic-y type of feel to it. If you think
it does,
Oasis and Verve and those kind of productions.
Well, do you know what? You've said it now as well. And so this was something I was talking to a couple of friends about who've mentioned stuff that ties into this. Mm. Is in some ways, it sounds like they're doing a production reminiscent of the bands that have been influenced by them.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
You know, in a sort of weird populate itself sort of way.
I need to mention, so that when I was away and listening to this, that I was visiting friend of the podcast, Nick, who, that was her point about this. Don't you think it sounds a bit 90s-y kind of in its production?
All right, that's quite a few people saying that.
And
though.
I hadn't heard it properly enough at that point to say so, because I'd only listened to a tiny little phone. And it's like, no, I see what she means. It's got big, not wall of sound, because that would be actually more, you know, Spectre and all that, but that 90s wall of sound, it doesn't let up by the end, but then that's, I don't mind that, but it's, I think.
But I will say as well, the master of it. So when you put a song out now, and I'm sure plenty of people know this, but maybe not, the final stage of any song production is mastering.
Mm.
And this is where you prepare the file, as it is now, to be as good as it can be for the format it's going into.
Yeah.
So whether that's vinyl or digital, and whether it's a digital physical format or whether it's streaming.
Yeah.
The master of the digital release of this, the pure streaming version, mm-hmm. the one that's on Apple Music and Spotify and stuff like that, is over-compressed because that's what's expected of the sound of things on streaming.
Yeah.
And it's not good.
Right.
And that put me off it a tiny bit when it first came out. And I was a little bit disappointed because it felt too much. And what that does is it kind of muddies the mix as it goes along.
Mm.
As the physical copies have turned up, the vinyl copy, the copy on CD.
Yeah,
and in fact, now the streaming version on the Blue Album, much better mastering. Less loud, less compressed.
It was, some people said they thought it was better in the video, and I kind of agreed with that. It felt like the mix.
Yeah, it might be.
It might be less compressed on the video.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think that's worth bearing in mind. I'm a very soppy man, and I was expecting to be absolutely torn apart by this, and I wasn't. And I think that's because I was listening on that streaming service, and I thought it became mushy, not in a good way, like I was going to become mushy. But I'm very, very pleased that it actually, since then, has, having heard it in the better mastered versions, that it's just absolutely stuck in my head, totally. Same with Lorraine, my partner. It's all, like, there was days afterwards, we were both waking up in the morning going, I've woken up with it in my head. Even after I hadn't gone to sleep thinking about it or anything like that, it's really, really got in there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Same here. I sing it around the house a lot, and that's been picked up by the family. Also sing it because they've heard me singing it. It's pretty much in there most of the time at the moment. So I'm going to give a verdict on its production. I think because of its technical uniqueness and the end result, I'm going to give it 89 for production. Because of its actual technical uniqueness as well.
Yeah, interesting.
You know, there's not many of songs that can boast such a kind of providence when it comes to how it's been achieved. So, so that's that. So then we go on to the lyrics then.
I know it's true. It's all because of you. And if I make it through, it's all because of you.
So for lyrics, I mean, a quick rundown of the lyrics. It's quite easy to run through. I know it's true. It's all because of you. And if I make it through, it's all because of you. I always give, I imbue them with such a sense of drama. And now and then, if we must start again, well, we will know for sure that I will love you. Now and then I miss you. Oh, now and then I want you to be there for me. Always to return to me. I know it's true. It's all because of you. And if you go away, I know you'll never stay. That's it, really, apart from repeats. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's again, they couldn't have accidentally left such a apt song, at least kind of in the title and themes you can pull out from it, to return to in 2023 as the final ever song. And imagine if his final ever song had been about, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a genre.
Lasers.
Or yeah. I'm trying to think of something he did.
Love lasers. The future is lasers of love.
Yeah,
they had to make a song out of that.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, yeah. It's, you know, it could have been whatever gets you through the night or something. That could have been the one he never got round to doing, but that's the one they had, you know, in a different universe. Yeah. It could have been something that was like, oh, cool, interesting, but no poignancy to it. And in this, even though the words are ostensibly, I would have thought, a love song, it's easily, you know, overlaid onto the whole legacy, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. And again, there's lots of podcasts who've gone into this and they've talked about the history of its song, its different versions, the excised material that they didn't use. And there's lots of talk about an issue from 1981 with Paul McCartney and Carl Perkins, when Carl Perkins apparently played a song to Paul containing the phrase "now and then,"
right?
That really seemed to upset Paul, and it turned out that Paul or Linda told Carl Perkins that was one of the last things that John said to Paul.
See you around now and then.
Yeah,
or keep in touch or something.
Yeah, keep now every now and then. Think of me every now and then, old friend.
Yeah.
There's no one to back this story up except Carl Perkins' own telling of it.
Right.
So, you know, take it with a pinch of salt or not. I don't know why he would lie about it. But that adds an extra layer as well if you're into all the legacy and the sort of coincidence and all that stuff, which makes up the sort of magic and mystery of music. And but yeah, you can find all that stuff out elsewhere. But actually, yeah, it's very slight material, but it's that now and then. It's the fact that it is through time.
It's literally those three words that really give it any kind of kind of. The rest of it is horses for courses, because I think they've cut out the bit where Lennon introduced the bit about I don't want to lose you, use you and abuse you, whatever it was. It's obviously got that kind of Lennon like walking a line of kind of using language, self kind of exploration and kind of guilt and all sorts of stuff tied into. But that's not in here. That's not in here. And and that kind of era-spanning context that it evokes is brought by us as a listener and by the context of the whole campaign. It isn't actually inherently in those lyrics. The lyrics to me are, you know, a makeup song with the partner that you've fallen out with kind of thing, you know. It's quite slight. So I don't want to give them more than they kind of... They serve a purpose, but in comparison to other lyrics, you know, of the Beatles, they're not the most evocative. Then even just looking at kind of the 90s songs, you know. But I like them. That's fine.
Give them a score, Gary. Come on.
I'm just thinking if there's anything I haven't said. Yeah, well, I've scored them 67 for lyrics.
Right, interesting.
Because I think I've naturally ended up looking at these all through these kind of the first songs my eyes went to in my old chart was where did I put Free as a Bird and Real Love, and how do I feel about it compared to them? Because that will start to get me somewhere around where I think not. It will either go above or below. It gives me a good marker to kind of, you know, as far as the three songs that existed after John had died and been made from his demos, that's kind of you in the same ballpark, at least, as from a starting point. So, yeah, it gives it overall, though, 79.
79 on the dot.
So do you want to know where that puts it in the chart, Paul?
Yes, I do want to know where it goes in the chart.
So in the chart, that would put it at number 46.
Really?
Yeah.
That's quite high up, really, isn't it?
It is quite high up. And the funny thing is that I don't know if it needs to be higher or lower. I can't figure it out. Because when you start, I mean, this is the ridiculousness of the exercise we undertook with the...
oh, yes, it's an absolute fool's errand from start to finish, and I don't know why we did it.
Because according to that, that put it between Dear Prudence and Girl.
Which is very interesting. Yeah.
It's a
John sandwich.
But it puts it kind of...
John on the outside, John in the middle. John sandwich time.
It puts it above... it puts it in between the two versions of Revolution... Now, as far as Free as a Bird, I think it put it above the two 90s songs.
My favourite, still Real Love.
Is it out of all three of them?
Even now, out of all three.
Is it?
Yeah.
Let me find out what that... So, Free as a Bird came in at 68, so it came in above that. And Real Love... came in at do live spreadsheets 96. So actually, for me, it goes this.
Well, that's because you're an idiot. But no, it's very hard to say. I mean, it kind of it's very weird to slot it into the spreadsheet because it everything is so weird and different.
Well,
and
some of those songs on that
wonderful.
Spreadsheet, I've been there. I've existed for what we're on about now, 60 odd years. And
well, six, yes.
And 60, that has existed as a product we could all hear for about 2 weeks.
3 weeks. yeah.
So it's very, very strange because even though I haven't been around for 50 odd years, or 60 odd years, the years I have been around, a lot of them have been spent listening to to songs in that chart that you know.
So that song, so Now and Then, is 45 years old as a song.
Yes.
But 3 weeks old as a
product
record,
as John would say, call it a bit of product, because it is. And yeah, so I'm happy with that. I don't think that would have rocked anyone's world, you know, going in at 46. I think if you've decided that you've hated it, like some people, few people, I'm glad to say, but some people who obviously like the attention, have decided, then maybe you won't like that, but. Yeah, I think that's a fair place for it to live for a little while, as all of the songs are. They're only living there. They change around in my mind. They can move whenever they feel like it. So, yeah, I think that covers that off quite well, Paul.
Yeah. Shall we have a little chat about Red and Blue and Beatles compilations?
Yeah, let's have a little chat about it. Let's also quickly talk about the video as well before we move on to them.
Oh, do we have to?
Okay, well, we disagree, don't we? You weren't a fan of the video.
I'm not a fan of the video at all.
No, you don't like it. I can see why people have gone, because you're not alone, are you? But then again, it's sowed that conversation, hasn't it?
Oh, it certainly has. The fact that Peter Jackson, who is obviously one of my favourite directors, I watched the Lord of the Rings extended editions very often, and will probably do so again over this winter.
Mm.
I love Peter Jackson. By his own admission, he said, "I don't know how to make a music video. Don't make me do it." And they went, "Do it, Peter." And he went, "No." And they went, "Do it, Peter." And he went, "No." And they went, "Do it, Peter," with the Beatles. And he went, "Okay."
Mm.
I still don't know how to do it. And he's just thrown technology at it. And I think it looks like something that you'd make out of the old templates you used to get on iMovie when you first bought a Mac decades ago.
Yeah, I'm not gonna say that it looks amazing. I just didn't mind it. I quite liked it. Something I liked its goofiness in a weird way. I didn't think it... You could really have lent into the song. Really, but then would that have come across as schmaltzy, or
I don't know if schmaltzy is the right word. But I think it's a poison chalice of a job to do.
Yeah.
But of course, the thing that I did like about it was those tiny little glimpses of archive material that I hadn't seen before, and I just want them.
Yeah.
That's what I want. You know, I'm not interested in the music video because it's a less relevant part of promotion now.
Because I think what you really wanted for something like this, they nailed with Free as a Bird, and you just couldn't do that again.
Yeah.
You just couldn't do that. That was done so well then. That was one of the best things about it. I think, really, you're kind of left with nowhere to go but Ringo in his tracksuit and the,
yeah,
you know.
Flipping out, dress up Ringo.
Come on, he can do what he wants. He's Ringo. So, yeah, but I quite liked it. But we won't go into it because we weren't here to talk about it. But I just wanted to mention.
I don't mind other people liking it. Just please don't, you know, make me watch it again.
You'd think that, you know, I'm sure there already must be people who have put something together out there that's better. Did you post one that an alternative?
No, I don't think I did.
Someone must have.
I'm not in the market for this. Oh, I've done a better version, or
I suppose
which a lot of people do, and I don't. It's a bit like those sort of here's how it would have sounded in 1964.
Yeah. Fan made videos. The problem is with something like that. The problem with the Beatles Legacy. I'll tell you what the problem is with the Beatles Legacy, Paul. Do you want to know what that is?
Oh, get it right. Sort it out.
Let's get it right. Miss McCartney, if you're listening, and Star, is that if anyone was to even try and put a video up with their kind of like a fan edit of something that they thought might be a bit more appropriate out of kind of love and stuff for the band, it would get instantly taken down because they are much more on their music doesn't go onto adverts or anything. And I think that is a mistake.
Oh, rarely.
I think they're right that they keep it guarded from being just overly used. But I do think they're missing out on a broader appeal nowadays from not just generally being easier to use and a little less. Maybe.
Well, they started to do things like have in things like, I assume, TikTok. I don't know. I don't use it.
Mm.
And Instagram, like, you know, a sort of use this to make your videos type thing.
Oh, right.
There's a bit more of that coming.
Right.
Now, but this is not the time to get into Apple's approach to promotion. Because that's a whole other story. That's something for the Nothing Is Real boys to take up. Yeah, not us.
We'll leave that to them. All right, then. Yeah. So let's talk about the compilations then.
Yeah. So Red and Blue, I'll state at the outset, and I think I've said it before, meant nothing to me growing up
at all.
Yeah,
nothing at all.
But we didn't have Beatles comp... No, we didn't. And Beatles compilations, however, did mean a lot to me. We had quite a few.
Yeah.
Being kids in the 80s and that being a way to get a lot of Beatles quite quickly. So if I just talk very quickly about the history of Red and Blue, and please forgive me anyone if I get anything wrong or miss it out here because I've not looked into it massively. If you think about the Beatles' career during their actual active time, they had only put out one compilation album, and that was the collection of Beatles oldies in 1966. And that was just done because it's like, oh, there's a big gap here. We haven't had a new product for Christmas. We need something to put out.
Yeah.
And so that was around for a bit, but was never really a big part of their legacy, and eventually sort of deleted out of the catalogue. And it's a sort of early collection stopgap thing. But you get to 1970 and the band's sort of, it's broken up fundamentally.
Yeah.
And then it has broken up actually. But you get Hey Jude, which we always had in our house because our parents had it on cassette.
Yeah.
Because they lived in Germany for a while and it only came out in America and Europe. It didn't come out in the UK.
Right.
So we always had in our house Hey Jude, which is a very weird compilation of early stuff through to late stuff. But that all still happens because of Alan Klein.
Yeah.
So he's renegotiated this contract for the Beatles with Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that contract is there must be a certain number of compilation albums over the coming years.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a demand for it because there's a company then in New Jersey, which I think was called Audio Tape Inc., and it put out this thing called Alpha Omega, which was a four-disc set, and they advertised it on telly, and it was a completely unofficial collection of Beatles stuff.
Okay.
And it was like literally lifted off records, you know, it was like needle-dropped recordings. They didn't have any master tapes or anything, so it's like this massive unofficial bootleg being advertised. And they did a second volume which started to put solo Beatles tracks on there as well.
Blimey.
So, funnily enough, they got sued.
Yeah.
But what it did show was that there was a market for that career spanning type of thing.
Yeah, because if you wanted to listen to everything, a little bit of the Beatles, you would have to get out all your records and put one on and put one track or two tracks on and then take it off and then put the next. You couldn't just relax and listen to it.
There's no common use of domestic sort of cassette recorders, particularly at the time. So you couldn't do make your own mixtapes and stuff like that. Yeah, so the demand was there. So Alan Klein, you know, pounds and dollars rotating in his eye sockets, gets his office, sets them to work and says, basically, come up with a track listing and a design for these, and we'll do two albums, Red and Blue, early career, late career. So it's Alan Klein and his team that come up with a track listing, which is why it's funny that we come to now and they've sort of redone the track listing. But this man whose association with them is important, but his legacy is very, you know, that's Alan Klein, you know.
Yeah.
Did this thing that basically went, this really made the band a lot of money in the 70s.
Yeah.
They didn't have any cover versions on them, so it was all original material. There wasn't much George, so he was probably narked about that because it's all about your publishing. They print the lyrics on the gatefold, which is quite a big thing because it's another way to sort of cement the songs in the minds of people by doing that read-along. But they're quite expensive, and they weren't number one albums in the UK at the time, but they were, across the world, these were huge sellers, the Red and the Blue.
Right.
And they've been reissued, I'll get onto that. But, like, after they get rid of Alan Klein, when they don't renew his contract in 73, I think, something like that.
Right.
He's already put a load of stuff in motion, you know, and he sues them and has all that business, and it's stuff that's not settled till the late 70s. But there comes out loads of Beatles compilations, which made up a massive part of the market for a long time. So if you think about the ones, do you remember the ones we had?
I remember Hey Jude, like you said, but I've got vague memories of the front of the tapes.
Yeah, well, you probably do because there were ones that I asked for. So I remember getting Rock and Roll Music.
Oh, yes, Rock and Roll Music. And was that Volume 1, that was it, yeah.
Yeah, first. And then I asked for Rock and Roll Music Volume 2.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still my favourite of the compilations, the rock and roll music. That had originally come out as one album, but then was split into two.
Mm-hmm.
There was a thing called the Love Song, Beatles Love Songs,
right, yeah.
Rarities, which was gathering up a bunch of stuff that hadn't been on anything else. The Beatles Ballads, a thing called Real Music, which I don't think I've ever seen a copy of, amazingly.
Right.
20 Greatest Hits comes out in 1982. Then there's a big gap.
I think I know the next one.
What is it?
Is it the one album?
No, it's Yellow Submarine.
Oh, right.
The song track.
Oh, cool.
Which is technically a compilation, isn't it?
Yeah, because it's not the Yellow Submarine album doesn't have the songs that aren't.
Yeah, it's a bit of a fudge to call that a compilation, but it is. But then, in the year 2000, One comes out.
Yeah.
And becomes the best-selling album of the 2000s. Yeah. The first decade of the 2000s.
Which is, was it 2000 that came out?
Yeah.
Blimey. I remember. Yeah, gosh. Because that's probably...
So that makes it 23 years since we had the last of the Beatles compilation.
Yeah, until now. We've had a reissue of a Beatles compilation.
Yeah. Okay, so... Yeah. So out of those ones, we had rock and roll music on tape. I think I had the Beatles Love Songs on tape. I definitely had the Beatles Ballads on tape. I had 20 Greatest Hits on tape. And then obviously the later ones I got on CD and stuff like that. I never had Rarities. I never got Real Music. I did do a little poll, only a few responders this time to our poll about what were people's favourite compilations.
Yeah.
And actually, the Blue Album came out as the majority one that people liked.
That's
and
I think later, that's, isn't it?
That's the later stuff, yeah. Real Music came out as the second most popular, and I don't know, I assume that's people being genuine in voting for it, but I don't think I've ever seen a copy of it.
I've never heard of it. We should say thanks to Tim Kellaway, who got in touch with a lot of his thoughts on this, and it was good to have a good exchange about that.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Tim Kellaway. That sort of your email came along while I was putting together my notes on compilations, because it is really interesting how that's useful to cement a legacy as well. Because it's a lot easier to buy rock and roll music volume 1 and volume 2 than it is as a kid or a teenager in the early 80s with barely any money to go and buy every single Beatles album.
Yeah.
For example. That's one example.
I think this is the thing for me. I think I've talked about it before, is that I think by the time I was really purposefully listening to the Beatles rather than just by proxy, because you were playing them, I was like going out my way. I was listening to the White Album and Sgt. Pepper's in their entirety. You know what I mean? I didn't go down the compilation album. I mean, when One came out, I had that feeling of like, well, it's nice that I'd like that people my age were getting into them now, you know, where they hadn't always before. But it was kind of like, yeah, but you're only listening to like the number ones. Like the best stuff's not always this, you know, these are great, but... They don't follow on from each other, such kind of thing. Whereas if you listen to an album, you get that experience of the album. I love the album. I love the album as a concept. So I've not ever really kicked into compilations. But I understand that thing, because I listened to the Red and Blue. I've listened to most of, if not all of them, over the last couple of days on stream in the new ones. And for me... because I'm used to the albums, when one of the songs finishes, my ears are telling me the next song I'm expecting, and then I don't get it, because I'm used to, you know, if Sgt. Pepper ends, I'm expecting, Little Help for My Friends to come next. If that doesn't happen, my ears go, what? But I guess if that's what you did grow up with, they become their own curated collection.
I think even Giles Martin was saying, you know, for him... he grew up with Red and Blue. He knew those track listings off by heart. And like I've said, I didn't own Red and Blue until only a handful of years ago. And I've said this before. Mum went to some auction or something and bought a job lot of mono and other bits and bobs, Beatles things, not knowing whether I had them or not. And Red and Blue were in there, or as they were, Orange and Blue, because they'd faded.
Yeah.
And that was when I first got them. And I think I played them once for the sake of it. And it's like, well, yeah, but the Red and Blue stuff was reissued in 1993 on compact disc. It was reissued in 2010 with, there'd been different vinyl variants. It had been on cassette and 8-track and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of, again, YouTube and podcasts you can go to if you want to hear about who did the different mixes and which one's the best mix and selection. But what we've got here now today is a fully redone thing. So the original track listing is intact, except on CD they've inserted a handful of songs for both collections. On the LP editions, they've stuck new songs on in third disc, which is a bit weird. So you have the original track listings over two discs and then a third disc with the new stuff separate, as it were. But I always get sort of albums on CD primarily, so the tracks are all nicely inserted on that. Yeah, and it's fascinating because they're going to be big hits as well, again. And they may have been, you may look at Red and Blue and go, well, they've been reissued so many times. It's like, well, yes, but like we said, there hasn't been a new Beatles compilation for 23 years. There's an audience for this now, a market for it.
And coming straight off the back of the Now and Then success, it's going to hopefully, those people who are looking for a way in are going to be like, well, there you go. And
I mean, there's going to be a few stockings full of Red and Blue this Christmas, I would have thought.
That's a nice thought, isn't it?
Yes. Take it out before you put the stockings on. So, yeah, interesting. I tell you what I did do, though, Gary.
What did you do, though?
I took your scores from the spreadsheet.
Okay.
Season one spreadsheet.
Oh, you clever monkey.
And obviously, and I had a look at which of the... So which do you think would be the highest scoring album, then, on average? The Red early album to 1966 or the Blue album 1967 to 70?
I'd say the Blue album, but, you know, that seems too obvious.
Well, it's... Yeah. By your system, it's clearly the Blue album because you like that.
Okay, so I was right.
You basically like Pepper Onwards more than the early stuff, don't you?
Well,
and so the average score for the original, this is the original track listings. Red gets 67.7 overall, and Blue gets 82.18. So it's quite a big difference in your system.
However, now I've
go
on.
Yeah,
oh, you've got a however, have you? I've got a however.
Well, I was following your however with my own however.
Well,
you've just
cancelled my however out.
Well, let's all go home.
Let me just do my however first. However, when I listen to the Red and the Blue albums over the last couple of days, do you know which one I enjoyed the most?
Better be Red.
It was the Red one. Because the Blue album songs, I want to hear them as part of their... I want to be listening to their album that they're on. Whereas the Red album songs, for the large part of it, kind of
you're not as attached to the albums.
I'm not as attached to the albums, so they flowed quite nicely into each other and whatnot. And then the Blue album songs, I'm like, I just felt cheated of the songs I wasn't hearing on the album. So when Within You Without You stopped and I didn't get Lovely Rita, is that right? When I'm 64, whichever one it comes after that, whichever one, I know when I'm listening to it, it's like a memory thing. I was like, oh.
I know what you mean.
Whereas I didn't get that so much with the first one, so it was good for bopping around the kitchen with my headphones on whilst I cooked some dinner.
Well, I also, so my however is that I also then factored in the new songs they've added into the albums.
Right.
So they've added 12 songs to the Red album.
Right.
Including some cover versions for the first time, which is really good.
Yeah.
Plenty more George stuff. And with the new songs, the additional 12 songs takes the score of the Red album from 67.7 to 64.4.
Oh, it brings it
down. So they've included songs that have dragged the total down via your stupid system.
Maybe they're using an inverse version of my system in order to do something better.
I don't
know.
Yeah. Just seeing what Gary says and
do the opposite.
Other way. But with the blues album, they've added 9 new songs. One of which is Now and Then.
Yes.
Which is fine, except that the album is 1967 to 1970. But I understand why they're doing it. It's so you have Love Me Do at the very start,
and
you have
Now and
Then at the very end as well.
But no...
It takes the score literally almost doesn't change at all. So...
Yeah. So, I know, it's a bit of a shame that Real Love and Free as a Bird don't get any kind of a look in at all. The only thing I'd say about it is that there's so many songs in it now that it's quite a bulky compilation. I mean, it's not it's not a one sitting type of thing anymore. That's the only thing.
No, long car journey.
Yeah, so yeah, it's a good spread, and I like the fact, yeah. like the thing, the reason I don't think one worked as a compilation for me, although I'm glad it did what it did for everyone, it was obviously worked for them, was I think you do like need a mixture of album tracks and things to really show that kind of real breadth of the work. So
I'm very impressed with the Red album anyway, because it's a now again now it now isn't the time to get into this, but they've used the demixing technology on stuff that to make stuff stereo for the first time ever properly. Yes. Things where like the original sort of work tapes are missing that they can't. So there's it's kind of fiddling with these very sort of precious artifacts like She Loves You.
Yeah.
You know, the Beatles' biggest selling single, the biggest selling single of the 60s in the UK, is now in stereo. Whether you like the mix or not is a different matter, but it's there.
I think it's fine. They haven't Lucas'd it, have they? They haven't gone, now the original mix doesn't exist. There's the 2023 mix now that you can listen to if you want to hear it in that context. Doesn't mean that you can't listen to the other one. Doesn't mean that it's not readily available.
Everyone's worried that that will be the case, but because this is made up of 2023 mixes or stuff from the special deluxe editions, but that's fine. It's modern market material.
Yeah.
What I think is a real reward is the Red album. The fact that you can hear like the guitar parts separated and you can get to hear what John's doing.
Yeah, there are some really interesting bits.
Some amazing things to hear.
Yeah, I did pick up on it that there was some bits I'm thinking, I've never heard that before, ever. Never heard that. That little bit of guitar there going that. There was something in, I can't remember now. I should have made notes, but I was too busy chopping carrots. But there was some bits that I've never heard that before.
Should have carved it into a carrot.
Some of it was like, you know, I'm hearing that. I've never heard it before. Do I need to be hearing it? I don't know. Because is it... Well, did I not hear it before because George Martin thought, we don't need to hear that as much? There's some of that about it. Just because you can uncover something doesn't mean you should. But again, it doesn't matter because I can go and listen to the old version if I want to as well. So it's fine. But
I think he's been quite good in the mixes. He hasn't just literally made it thoroughly modern mixes with the drums all in the middle and or you know like the kick always in the middle and the bass always in the middle. He's done some interesting stuff. He hasn't done something terrible to it, Giles Martin.
My
one of my favourites on there is You Can't Do That. That sounds brilliant. Yes. That's absolutely fantastic. I love the George stuff on there as well. What else is like, We Can Work It Out? That sounds brilliant. You can really hear the parts in that now. You can really hear the harmonium swell. It's you know you can almost hear the mechanism, which I love as well. The I Am the Walrus mix has been a bit controversial because the ending is completely bonkers. He's brought up the radio sounds to the point where they kind of drown out the actual string fade. If, like me, you like to hear all the weird little things in the background, that's good. I can't criticise it for that in that sense. I think it loses some of its energy, but that's a debate for a different time.
Again,
it doesn't matter.
No,
as they say in Stoke,
it doesn't matter, mate. Because
the mix of Revolution, the new mix of Revolution that's on there, is really, really good.
Yeah, I think so. I think they're good. I think, there's a lot in there to talk about, which we have not got the time to carry on talking about right now. But I think the main thing is to listen to it for yourself and just remember, if you don't like it, you could listen to the old one like that. So
put the old one on.
Good. It's been a good time to be a Beatles fan.
Yeah,
this year for me, it's been a good time to be a Beatles fan and a Blur fan, and fingers crossed, a Doctor Who fan. You know, lots of hopefully good things this year, 2023. At least in entertainment ways, has been a good one.
Yes, it has been a continuation of the horrors of everything.
Yeah.
What larks?
Quick, want to do a quick mention before we go because it ended up being a really long episode. But I mean, you know, we're only doing the one. Every now and again.
The sound you may have just heard behind me was my sound baffle falling over because I turned around because I'm sat in my chair in a casual manner like David Frost.
Very good. That's a bafflingly interesting Bafflingly.
Oh, you've said it again. Don't get stuck on that again,
anyway,
Barry.
So, one other thing, quick mention. I want to say I'm enjoying reading the new book from Kenneth Womack.
The Mal Evans book.
We won't get stuck into details at this point. I'm still reading it, but that's...
As are many people. I'm glad to see it seems to have been selling very well. I hope so, Ken.
Yeah, it's cool. And then finally, just to say that, to give you an update, I think I might have said somewhere that we're going to give you a full Series 4 update, but we're not. We're being naughty. What we're going to do is we're going to do a December episode where we'll do Series 4 Episode 0, a zero episode, a primer episode, an episode to really get into into what we're going to be doing and how it's going to work.
Reveal that we're pivoting to a Terry Gilliam's The Zero Theorem podcast, where we're going to watch the film and just talk about it every week.
Right, which would be great because I don't think I've ever actually watched it.
I wouldn't worry about it. There's a reason. There's no Zero Theorem podcasts.
Right. That's not happening then. No. So
how did that get into my head? Sorry. Zeros, that's why.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, hopefully, December, you will have something to listen to from us to get you all ready for the new year, where we should be embarking on Series 4. And
yes.
You'll just have to wait for that then. So, where we go. I think we've comprehensively sorted all out. Unless they find
all Beatles
more,
sorted.
All Beatles done, I think. But, you know... Who knows? Let's not quite completely.
Carnival of Light. Carnival of Light. Carnival of Light. Best left in the vaults, in my humble opinion.
Right. Okay. With that very strange, weird voice, let's go. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
And a very modern, merry Beatles to you all at home.